The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Donald Trump is now officially the president of the United States. Dow Jones Industrial Average hits a six-week low. And it looks like the bloom is off the Trump rose. And our guest today, Harry Dent, best-selling author and economist and editor of the free newsletter, Economy and Markets. All this and much more on episode number 493 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, yeah, here we are. A new world, a new president. It seems that it's official. I don't know if you had the opportunity to watch it, but the inauguration was pretty interesting. Yep, this is Andrew Horowitz, and I'm the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Glad you are with me today. It's kind of an interesting bunch of events that happened over the last several days, not to mention the last several months, but all this has been very reactive in terms of investments. I hope you have been enjoying an interesting time. One of the things that we did, we added some to the gold positioning that we have for clients. Actually, from a trading standpoint, what was, if you were able to look at objectively the whole opportunity for a quick trade, I mean a very quick trade, for those of you who are involved in day trading or swing trading, one of the things that I picked up over the years was that on the presidential election nights and on the presidential inauguration, there seems to be a very interesting opportunity that arose in that when the election happens, it seems that there's a lot of euphoria going into the election and then a quick drop off overnight if you trade futures. The same thing happens during the inauguration. As soon as the president begins speaking, it seems that there's a bit of a drop off, a bit of a potential for a short side trade, or at least moving out of the way for a little while. Again, this is very short term. This is not your normal longer term, at least multi-day trades. I'm talking about minutes. And lo and behold, it happened again. As soon as Donald Trump started to speak after he was inaugurated, what happened? Markets swooned. As a matter of fact, the Dow Jones Industrial Average went negative for a period of time. It closed today on Friday up about 95 or 96 points. But during the day, as he was speaking and giving his initials, first time ever speech as president of the United States, there was some concern about his tonality, I think it was, and his overall harshness and his discussion points that he had brought about and the lack of some of the detail. Again, I wouldn't expect that there would be a significant amount of detail that would be brought right then and there during this particular speech, but it seems like the markets are looking for that at every single opportunity and every time that he speaks. Hoping for, yeah, we're going to get tax reform tomorrow. You know, we're going to do it tomorrow. We're going to get all these things that we have in terms of jobs done today. And every time he pushes back on it, like he did recently on the border tax, there was an overwhelming sigh of disappointment. So we're going to be, I think, very much entertained from an investment situation, from the way that the Twitter tweets go out for, attacking a variety of different areas and companies and sectors and all the different speeches and things that he talks about. I think it's going to be a very interesting number of opportunities for very quick trades, but we'll see what happens moving forward on that. Now, in terms of what has gone on over, what has gone on over the last week or so. Yeah, the Dow is down for the week. As a matter of fact, hit a six-week low, which, not a big deal. Didn't really come off that much after such a wonderful rally post-election. NASDAQ seems to be holding up very well. Economic news that has been coming out has been rather, I would say, positive. And it has been very supportive of markets. Earnings that have been coming out, I think we all know that the earnings, there was no way that earnings could match the fundamentals of where stocks have gone over the last several weeks. Because the momentum of stocks over the last several weeks have been very simply based on the outward and longer term opportunity of all the things that we've mentioned, inclusive of tax reform and tax relief, lower tax levels, and maybe a America first, America here, America now concept in terms of how we're going to, you know, really be working here and a lot more employment and kind of doing away with a lot of the external opportunities and really focusing on America. I mean, you know, all these things that have been talked about, but that can't be put into play so fast. Talked about this last week on the podcast, the Disciplined Investor podcast. If you haven't listened to that episode, we have talked about very intensely the whole idea that investors are seeing the cup as full, not half full, not a quarter full, not half empty, but full to the brim. They're saying that we're getting all of this and we're going to buy stocks with the idea that we're going to get all of this implemented and therefore we're going to fully value things. And it's not going to play out exactly like that. Now, what's going on in terms of some of the things that we've seen also with regard to earnings? Well, we did see a lot of bank earnings and there was some decent numbers. Clearly, there's some better trading numbers and revenue that have been generated by the banks and the financials over the last several months, over the last quarter. And their outlook has been very, I would say, optimistic, hoping for a lot of these changes of a reduction in the regulatory environment, stranglehold that the government has put on them. And that's going to all be very beneficial to them if it does get into play. We saw things like Netflix, even though they had a cash burn of about $600 million, have a very good subscriber growth and earnings number, domestic and internationally. You know, again we seem to all discount, or at least those bulls involved in Netflix seem to discount their cash burn, which could amount to about maybe $1.5 billion plus or minus a few hundred million through the next year. But there is the idea that their original content and their distribution has been growing in such a way that it's going to be really good for the company long term. Now, as predicted, I don't think anybody thought this was not going to be the case. The whole disruption on Fifth Avenue and in the area of the Trump Tower, where President Trump now has $1 million a day of New York City-based security and now Secret Service that is protecting that whole area, quarantined off a lot of the street, has really hurt companies like Tiffany's. We saw that Tiffany's had a 14% drop in its flagship New York City store due to this disruption that we've talked about. Target came in very soft, not related to the Trump issue, but Target came in very soft. Concerns about Walmart, concerns about many of the big box retailers, Macy's, Kohl's, Dillard's, et cetera, has been flowing through. They put out some announcements and pre-announcements recently that they're going to see some concern. We saw the Rails come in with okay numbers. And then all of a sudden, there was a very interesting turnaround in one of them, CSX in particular. We saw that the CEO from Hunter Harrison, who resigned a few months ago, is now getting involved with some activists, and they're going to team up and try to take over management at CSX. Stock was up about 23% overall on this news, even though they were down about 4 or 5% after they came out with their earnings. But this really provided some opportunity. So that was kind of interesting. Some retail brokerage houses missed earnings estimates. GE missed also. Their revenue dipped a little bit. Their earnings fell about 11.5% from a year ago. That was kind of an interesting story as well. What else do we see in terms of earnings here? We saw Qualcomm. This was not an earnings story as much as the fact that the Federal Trade Commission has a suit against them on anti-competitive tactics, monopolistic tactics that were used to force Apple in particular to use its chips exclusively in return for a better deal. And that kind of rocked the stock a little bit. But then Apple came out the next day and also have, a $1 billion lawsuit against the company. Now that the FTC is involved, Apple's like, hey, wait a minute. Yeah, no kidding. Look what they did. But meanwhile, Apple got better better cost on this whole deal. So I'm not sure exactly what they're hoping to get, because they did enter into this deal with them. They could have gone outside, but they decided to stay in there. We did see Bristol Myers, which it announced that it will not continue the process they have for approval of one of their major drugs related to lung cancer. Dropped about 11.5%. That was a pretty substantial move from one of the quote-unquote blue-chip pharmaceutical biotech-related companies. And I thought that was kind of an interesting scenario here. When you do see that kind of opportunity, is it more than just this one drug, or is it something else, or is it really an opportunity to look into buying the stock? So take a look at BMY. I thought it was interesting that UnitedHealthcare, who pulled out of all of the Affordable Care Act areas, and they kind of just said, you know what, we're not doing this anymore. Their fourth quarter earnings were up 51% compared to a year ago. Wow. So not only is, according to the earnings numbers that we see here, the Affordable Care Act, the Affordable Care Act, that's kind of funny. The Affordable Care Act, are they actually hurting the companies that are involved in it? And also the cost factors and the coverage is a problem for individuals. And you put this all together and you got to wonder, maybe there is something to this whole idea of repealing it. Question is going to be, of course, what is it going to be replaced with? You have to replace it with something. You can't just all of a sudden just repeal this whole thing. That would be an administrative and just a nightmare for people themselves. So it's an administrative nightmare as well as a nightmare from a standpoint of health insurance. Now, maybe UnitedHealthcare said, you know what, we know this is going to come, so we might as well be ready for it. And people start to think about getting insurance directly with us instead of going through any of the state-led healthcare programs that are affiliated with the Affordable Care Act. So anyway, we have all that. There was some other interesting things that have been going on in the markets. Coming out next week, we have Microsoft earnings coming out. We have McDonald's. We have Starbucks. Intel. We have Qualcomm coming out. Texas Instruments, United Technologies. Caterpillar is going to report on Thursday. A lot of people are saying that Caterpillar has really gotten way ahead of itself. A few major players have gone on the short side of that. We're going to see also earnings from Bristol Myers, which should be interesting. Biogen on the drug and medical sector area. AbbVie, which is a company that we hold that we really like. So some interesting things happening next week. And the continuation of whether or not the Fed is going to stay part of this whole process or they're going to start raising rates. There's been a lot of question about that. One of the things we did see last week was that the dollar did come in after some commentary by Donald Trump earlier in the week that says something about that the dollar is too high and we got to watch it. And dollar came in pretty significantly, and that helped out a variety of sectors. Markets weren't too happy about that. The whole thing has been that, dollar up, markets up, money coming into the U.S. has been very beneficial for many stocks out there. So kind of an interesting, situation that is brewing of late. And I think it's very interesting to watch how the whole reaction of comments, but also more importantly, is how we're seeing these cross asset classes work together, where you have things like, currencies and how it affects stocks and then how it affects bonds and then commodities. A lot of it and the interrelationship of it is really fascinating these days. I don't think there's any one particular answer on, dollar up, do this, dollar down, do that, euro up, do that, euro down, do that. I don't think it's that significant in that manner, but still very interesting. Now, before we get to the guest today, Harry Dent, I want to mention that if you go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, first of all, there's a brand new design, a brand new way of looking at things, a whole interesting way of searching for podcast guests, stock names, stock symbols. Click on those. They'll pull up all the different podcasts that were related to that. But basically, if you go there, you could also get access to a daily update of what's going on. You could follow us on Twitter. Check it out at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And on with us is Harry Dent. He's a best-selling author and economist. He has a new book out, The Sale of a Lifetime, and how the great bubble burst of 2017 through 2019 can make you rich. He's also the editor of the free newsletter, Economy and Markets. And Harry has been a guest many times in the past. We're going to actually put some links on where you could find it over on the Disciplined Investor, all the different times he's appeared. But I think it was 2014 was the last time you were on.
That could have been.
Yeah, it was some time ago. So I'm glad to have you back. Let's talk about a variety of things. I read the book cover to cover, and very interesting. I'm always fascinated with your various cycles, trends, and outlooks. But let me kind of set this up, and we can talk about this. So the thesis, your projections, your predictions are that there's going to be, I guess, a reckoning over the next 4 to 6 years or so, starting very soon, that there's going to be a tremendous amount of grief felt in markets due to a whole bunch of things, and that eventually it's going to create a massive opportunity. Is that pretty much the setup?
Yeah. I mean, we've been putting off this crisis now since, early 2008, government's just printing money to cover it over. Banks don't really write down or get rid of zombie debts. Bubbles are created again in stock markets and real estate. And every day the demographic trends get worse, as they've been since late 2007. Debt's higher than it was before the last crisis. And when you look globally, it's way higher. The emerging countries have really taken on a lot of debt. So yeah, I mean, all we've done is create another bubble at a time. And everybody's thinking, all Trump has to do is cut some taxes and create a little stimulus and we're going to grow 3-4%. I mean, our workforce is not growing. All we've been doing is hiring back people that were laid off in the Great Recession. And we're about running out of those people, as Janet Yellen said the other day, that hey, we're back at full employment or very close. And workforce growth, which I can project decades in advance, is just simply young people entering at age 20 on average and older people retiring at age 63 on average. And that basically says our workforce is going to shrink a little bit in the next several years. And then it's going to grow extremely slowly, like less than 0.2%. Our productivity is back at near zero because older people, aging baby boomers, don't get more productive. They get less. I mean, people start dropping out of the workforce, then they retire, stop working altogether for many people, and then they die.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how do you create this 3-4% growth out of this? And the truth is you don't. And I think it's going to take maybe several months for the market to get over this Trump rally, which looks, like it's got another couple rounds to go before people realize, no, you're not going to grow up 4%. Now, you might get a few quarters of growth because everybody just somehow thinks Trump's going to wave a magic wand, and I don't think you're going to get it. So I think there's a big disappointment coming, but it probably, compared to when I wrote the book late last year, I would have expected the markets to start to roll over. And as soon as Trump got elected, they went straight up. So the markets really have bought and are convinced that Trump is going to make some major changes, which some of them will be major. But a lot of them are just going to create a lot more debt. And so they're convinced that things are going to change. And I think it's, by second half of this year, they're going to think otherwise. I think especially jobs are going to drop off. I think we just come to the point where we run out of people to hire back and the workforce keeps contracting because of the retirement of the baby boomers. That's totally projectable. We started at 67%, in 2007 or something, and it's projected to go to about 58% participation because the retirement of baby boomers, we're at 62% now. So, I mean, the workforce is not going to get bigger. It's going to get smaller. And so at some point, we're just not going to be able to even create this 150 to 200,000 jobs a month we've been getting. I think we could see a surprise later this year, maybe this summer or fall, when all of a sudden, oh my gosh, the jobs, the non-farm payroll jobs are coming in at 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80,000.
So what do you you say, I mean, you obviously had to adjust a few things in concept because, Trump is doing what he's doing, or at least the markets and the investors and the environment is that, hey, there's a change. But does this whole populism trend, this new kind of sweep out the old and get in the new, change any of your markers here in terms of, we'll talk in a moment about some of these cycles, but does it change anything with some of the things that are happening around the world with Brexit, with Trump and what's going on in Europe? Or is this just kind of part of what it's kind of baked in already?
Yeah, it really is bacon. I did an analysis a few months ago in our newsletter, and I listed globalization, you know, global trade as a percentage of global GDP. And the first big globalization boom was in the, you know, late 1800s with steamships and then railroads. And then we hit World War I, the Great Depression, and World War II. And 33 years, we went way backwards on global trade. I mean, global trade almost disappeared. And then, of course, after World War II, everything was great again. And now you got jet travel, and then you got the internet to follow that. And I think this Trump thing and Brexit and the Italian referendum and, you know, the rise of, you know, the far right party in France and on and on and on and on, and trade wars already being threatened between Trump and China and Mexico and stuff. I think this is the beginning of something that's going to last for many years or even decades. And that's not good. I mean, it always makes sense for each individual country like the United States to say, well, hey, if we get a little tougher on trade policies, we'll get some more jobs back here. No, it doesn't work that way. Everybody gets tough. Everybody retaliates like they did in the 1930s. And global trade just goes down. That slows GDP growth. But also it slows efficiency because every country's not good at everything, yeah, including China. And you know, specialization in trade do make sense. It's just, I think the everyday person, especially the middle class and lower middle class and in developed countries like the United States, they have lost a lot of jobs to China or Mexico or wherever. And they're thinking there's some magic cure to it. If we have some trade war with China, hey, yeah, they're going to get hurt, but we're going to get hurt too.
Right. You're not even mentioning automation, robotics, technology advancements. These are actually, I think that's a major theme in the whole jobs market that has been overlooked dramatically.
Yeah, no, I mean, and this is going to continue to happen. And in Japan, it's necessary. Japan has so many old people and so few young people. They're going to have robots just to take care of the nursing homes. What I look at, Andrew, and you know, everything runs in cycles. Generations spend and then they don't spend because older people at some point spend less after the kids leave the nest. Technologies, there's always innovation, but technologies have periods like 1988 to 2010, like 1942 to 65, where they really move mainstream, like automobiles back then and highways and all this sort of stuff and TV and all. And now internet and broadband and personal computing. And right now, hey, there's innovations in social media and stuff. But even things to talk about robots and biotech and stuff are still not in mainstream mass markets. And they won't be for many years to come. So we're in a pause between the baby boom generation and millennials. And the millennial generation is not as big as economists say it is. It only takes us back to where the baby boomers were at their peak, and they're nowhere near their peak yet. And more baby boomers are going to be retiring than these young millennials entering for many years, so that's not good for the economy. In countries like Japan and East Asia and most of Europe, there almost is no millennial generation to come along and bring up spending and new house buying and have more kids and all these things and raise families. So the demographic trends are really clear, and they're really not good. They're negative the next several years in most of the developed world. And then we grow very slowly, even globally, because emerging countries, yeah, they're going to be growing. They've got strong demographics. But most developed countries are going to continue to slow for decades to come. I mean, aging is real. Aging is projectable. And older people don't get more productive. That's why our productivity rates are back near zero. The increasing retirement and aging of the baby boom generation. They spend less, they pay down debt, they don't drive their cars as much, they buy almost all their real estate between age 27 and 41, and then they buy very little in vacation homes and retirement homes, or they downsize after that, and then they die. So we've never had a situation where for the typical developed country, wealthy country out there, the next generation is actually smaller than the one before it, the baby boom. And that has massive implications and nowhere more than real estate, as we show in the book.
And one of the things that you talk about very interestingly in the book, and by the way, you can get his free newsletter, Harry Dent's free newsletter, Economy and Markets. We'll put a link directly on the show notes of this show, so you can grab that, or you can go right to Harry Dent's site, I'm sure, and get it there as well. But one of the things that you talk about, which you just talked about again, is the whole idea about this millennial generation. Now, we've seen on news and commentary and just from all sources that, oh, the millennials, they're coming. And all of this, and, you know, this massive move and this inheritance that they're going to get, the spending that's going to happen, and that it's been talked about that they are the largest generation in history. But you go back and look at the baby boom, and you talk about really one of the big factors in the whole baby boom generation in that time period was the immigration that went on. And there's a significant lack of that comparatively now. And therefore, when you calculate the total amount of people that were in that spending range, that the millennials are really not as big. Am I correct in restating?
That's right. They're not quite. They don't come quite to the same height as the United States. They're much lower in most of Europe, Southern Europe, Central Europe, and in the East Asian countries. And China actually has no millennial generation. Their workforce has already peaked in 2011. Is starting to decline slowly. In about 8 years from now, it'll start to decline rapidly. So even China, the four largest countries in the world, we're the best looking of all of them in demographics, and all we do is go sideways for decades. China shrinks, Japan shrinks rapidly, Europe shrinks rapidly, and nobody's looking at this and thinking, well, somehow there's something to make up for this. Well, the thing to make up for that would be sharply rising productivity, but older people don't get more productive either. They get less, and then they stop working, and then they die. So this is not hard to project. It's just nobody wants to look at it.
Yeah. So you know, one of the things, there's so much in this book to talk about. There was, and correct me if I'm wrong about some of this, but there's a variety of cycles that are out there that you talk about. And, you know, for those people who look at some of these cycles as short-term and as long-term, I mean, you in the back of the book, you talk about, I mean, I laugh because it's kind of interesting. Like the 500-year civilization cycle, the $100,000-year glaciation cycle, the 1 billionth-year climate cycle. We're not going to talk about those. What I want to talk about is some of the cycles that you see as converging and as some of the baseline for your commentary on why we're going to see some problems. And that is the 39-year generational spending cycle, the 34 to 46-year geopolitical cycle, the 8 to 13-year boom-bust cycle, and the 45-year innovation cycle, right? Those four.
Right, and all four of those, they started, the geopolitical went down first in 2001 with 9/11. That was only obvious to me afterwards. I discovered that news cycle because of that, and of course, that's been very clear since. This innovation cycle with the internet just peaked recently, and now we're down to Facebook with dancing dogs and cats. I mean, Facebook is great, but
have you noticed the dogs also? You know what I do? I have a new rule. When I thumb through Facebook on my iPhone, when I get to a dog, I mark it as, okay, there's one. When I get to the next one, I shut it down. I can't take it. We need to make
it. You know, the baby boomers peaked in late 2007, just as we said they would 20 years before, because it's just a 46-year lag on spending. And then, of course, we've been on quantitative easing ever since. And the Japanese peaked before them and the European after them. And the last cycle to click in was this boom-bust cycle that Ned Davis has always said averages 10 years, but it's not. It oscillates between 8 and 13 years, and we just had an abnormal one. And it is based on sunspot cycles, I finally found out after seeing Ned Davis's 10-year cycle fail a couple times. I said, well, there's something else going on here. And I found that 88% of the recessions since the mid-1800s have come in the downside of this sunspot cycle. All of the major financial crashes and panics have come in the downside of this. So this is no coincidence and a very powerful tool. That turned down in 2014. All four of these cycles are down at the same time into around early 2020, and then one after the next start to turn up. So it's particularly the next, I'd say, 3 years that are the most dangerous. And it'd be very surprising to me if we don't see a major downturn in that time period. And this is the very time period that Trump's walking in saying, hey, I'm just going to turn this whole thing around. No sweat. Just lower some taxes and cut some regulations and then people will start spending money. Old people don't spend money. And the millennials are only half entered the workforce. They're not big enough a force to counter the baby boom decline yet. And they won't be until the early 2020s, about 6 years from now. So Good luck to anybody who's going to try to create 3 to 4% growth. I think he's just going to give a lot of tax cuts, and the deficit's going to, you know, explode, and people are still not going to spend money.
You know, by the way, I want to just backtrack, because if I don't, I think my listeners will throw a conniption here. Sunspots. And I'm not saying this in an insulting way, because you even commented this on this book, because every time I listen to, you know, somebody talk about sunspot activity related to markets or economies and things like that, I start to get a little bit hazy. And even you said in the book that you were reluctant for a long time to either adopt or even look at, because people would think you were crazy. And
but well, I've looked at them. I look at every cycle. That's the reason I'm better. I hate to say it, because I'm willing to think out of the box. But something has to prove itself to me with a lot of correlation and research, and it's got to make sense. And so, yes, when this happened, because Paul McCulley, one of the largest fund managers in the country years ago, said what saved him from the 2000-2002 crash was sunspot cycles. So I looked at them before, and it's 11-year cycle. I'm like, well, I don't see anything correlating 11 years. So I discounted on that alone. But then I said, well, you know, maybe I better look back at this. And I went back in the time that Ned Davis did his 100-year research and came up with a 10-year decennial cycle, stock markets tending to be down in the first 2 to 3 years of every decade, which did mostly work out. I realized, no, sunspot, it has been 10 years. This thing is not a constant. And so I said, well, now this is starting to make sense. So I tested. I spent 3 or 4 months testing this, analyzing it back, you know, 150, 200 years. And I found out, man, no, this does correlate. And I found a book from the early 1900s where a guy had proven this back then. Nobody would listen to him. And I finally went out to my subscribers at a conference and threw it out there. And a lady saved me. She got up in the audience and said, look, I'm a nurse in an emergency room, and my husband's a policeman. We can both tell you that just on a full moon with a little extra sunlight reflected, people go nuts. You know, wolves howls, and there's many more accidents and murders and stuff, and all types of stuff and crime. And she said, I can see this, the radiation in the sun over this approximate 10-year cycle is 20% higher. That means rainfall and evaporation is 20% higher, and on. But to me, it's probably just energy. People feel more energy. They probably feel a little better and a little more optimistic. So, yeah, I mean, I took a while because this is, I mean, you know, my generation cycle makes a lot of sense. Innovation cycle makes a lot of sense. Geopolitical, only in retrospect, after we've seen how weird things have been since 9/11, how they continue to be around the world. But this one, I'm like, oh, man, people are going to give me flack about this. But you know what? Once I proved it myself, I'm like, okay, sorry. Yeah. I'm going to say it anyway, because this is the most impactful on actual recessions and stock market crashes.
Now, one of the things you point out in the book over and over again, as a matter of fact, you when I say over and over again, I as I was reading the book, I was like, wait, he talked about this in the last chapter. But in a different way, you talk about this whole deleveraging as a major point of contention in terms of the bleak opportunity, bleak problems, the problems ahead. You're very critical, or been critical, about the monetary policy, or at least talking about how monetary policy has done nothing more than to postpone the inevitable. But you talk about deleveraging not only here. I mean, we've had a massive amount of growth. I mean, on page 257 of the book, you talk about China's debt has grown a multiple of 16 times since the year 2000. And what are they doing with that? You can go to page 18 on chapter 18, page 247. You look back at that and talk about the ghost cities where they're building houses for nobody, and how, you know, how is that going to end?
It ends the same way it always does through history. It doesn't end well. When debt bubbles, and debt in the United States grew 2.6 times GDP from 1983 to 2008 for the entire baby boom boom. China, it's grown much faster in a shorter period of time. Debt bubbles lead to financial asset bubbles. Real estate compared to income is the highest of anywhere in the world, in Hong Kong and then in China. So surprise, surprise. Mm-hmm. And those debt bubbles, empty homes everywhere, empty condos, empty malls, empty office buildings, you name it, empty railway stations. at some point they're going to collapse, and the Chinese are going to lose all the wealth. Because the Chinese put 75%, now let me repeat that, 75% of their wealth in real estate, not much in stocks, not much in bonds, and they're willing to let real estate sit empty and own it anyway and not even rent it out. The craziest thing I've ever seen. So the Chinese, really smart in a lot of ways, really dumb when it comes to investing in real estate. And this thing's going to blow, and it's going to see wealth basically evaporate way faster than it did for the Japanese. Now, remember, the Japanese real estate boom similar, not as extreme, and it burst in the early 90s along with their economy. I was the only guy on the earth, I think, that predicted that, because it was a bubble, and their baby boom was peaking way earlier than the rest of the Western world and developed world. And real estate's never come back. Stocks went down 80%, came back only down 50. Now they're down 60. They'll be down 80 before you know it again. Never coming back, because more old people than young people forever, as far as the eye sees. They don't really have a substantial millennial generation. And even that generation turns downward in their spending and demographic trends from 2020 forward. And that's only 3 years from now.
And I think the biggest head scratcher is, you know, we know what happens with demographics. I mean, if you look, I think it's apparent. If you just look at Japan only, just forget everybody else in the world.
Yes.
Just look at Japan, what the markets have done, what the government has done, what they've tried to do to reflate and then, you know, add debt and monetize debt and then to go negative interest rates and all the things that they've done, which it seems like that's a model for what not to do, by the way. That's what they did. And they've gone into recession many times over the last number of years since this whole demographic change, since the real estate bust and all that. And really not much is better there. And because they have one of the greatest aging populations of all. But why is nobody looking at this saying, oh, well, yeah, no, that is a model that what we shouldn't do, right?
It is. And it has had some, the positive thing, which I consider a negative, but the banks never deleveraged, never had to write down loans because they just keep pumping money in. Interest rates are down to zero. Government has the largest debt by far of any country in the world and growing the fastest. Yet, when you're paying zero interest rates because mm-hmm. you buy your own bonds and suppress rates, you know, and own all your own bonds, so there's no public to trade it anymore, then, you know, you can get away with that longer. But obviously, it's not a good long-term strategy. And to me, what's happened in Japan, I call it the coma economy. They've just gone into coma. If you really look at it since that big crash in the 90s, they've grown at about 0% with zero inflation and zero productivity. That's a coma. They're just barely alive. Now, they could have darn near died. I mean, they didn't go through a Great Depression, but like you say, they've been an on-and-off recession for decades now. They've got 2.5 lost decades now. Real estate crashed 65%, never bounced significantly, still down that much. Stocks still down, you know, 60% off their all-time highs. They'll never see 39,000 Nikkei again. Never, ever, not in my lifetime, not in your kids' lifetime. So this is what happens when you have a demographic peak. And on top of that, you don't do anything to deal with it. You don't encourage higher births or higher immigration. You don't let debt deleverage, even at the expense of some banks going under, to take the debt burdens off an aging society. That's the only thing that can help. Old people don't spend more money, but if they still got to pay an overvalued mortgage, you know, decades later, then they're going to be less well off. Same with businesses. A lot of debt basically should have been written off because it went into overbuilding things that weren't needed. But when you carry that debt continues to be a weight on the economy. And that's what the Japanese do. They've got 650% debt to GDP versus our 385% at our peak.
Right, which is nothing small. I know we only have a couple of minutes left, and let me just mention a few things. So, again, in the book, you talk about specific areas in downside risk in real estate. Chapter 22 talks about, I think, Miami, San Francisco, New York. You also talk about, you know, what to do if you have a business now and what to look out for and what's going to happen. You talk about the opportunities after the crash. Look for opportunities, things like the things that are related to the baby boomers later in life, like healthcare, age-defying products, cruises, retirement. So this is massive deleveraging and cycles converging. A crash starts about 2017-ish into about 2022, 40-50% downside for equity markets. Crude could be down to $10. Gold's going to crash. There's a lot going on. I really encourage people to grab the book over on wherever it's sold, Amazon, et cetera. We had a couple of questions from listeners that wanted to ask. And one of these relates to what you're talking about, which is the whole demographic issue with regard to, you mentioned Japan, they didn't have the growth and all. But this is from Robert Saguan. He says, can you explain how China's one-child policy and the recent changes will affect Asian commerce and economies?
Yeah, and the answer is it already has. I mean, that started in the early 70s and was more enforced as the 70s went on and ever since up until recently. And China's the only emerging country in the world. We show in the book, emerging countries have plenty of demographic growth ahead, especially India as an example. China doesn't. China's workforce already peaked in 2011. They're aging. And 10 years from now, they're going to be aging as fast as Japan has been. And their only growth engine has been urbanization, but they've been overbuilding, pushing rural migrant workers into the cities for the low-end jobs and stuff. And now even those migrant workers are going back to rural areas because the real estate's way too expensive, the smog is absolutely choking, and they're treated like second-class citizens and have no governmental benefits for their kids. A lot of them have to leave their kids back in the countryside with their grandparents because they can't even get an education in the cities because they're not registered citizens. So this is a disaster happening. The over-urbanization, overbuilding, and the past excuse was, well, we're going to need it down the road anyway, so it's okay if we got, you know, 50 million empty condos or something like that. It's not okay when those rural migrants start to go home instead of keep coming. And literally in 2015, I think 7 million of them went home for the first time in decades, and boy, that should be a red flag, unbelievable. So China has got the biggest bubble in modern history, and I think because of so much top-down government push, they did everything more than Japan and more than Europe and us, stimulus, overbuilding, over-government involvement and investment. I think they're going to see the biggest bubble burst in history in the next 3 to 6 years.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was there, and I reported back on these ghost cities, and I actually went around, asked a lot of questions. I said, who's moving into these? And everybody that I said, I don't know, because all these buildings that they're building are not affordable. So the only thing we could think of is that they're going to do is to burn these down and crash them down and try to rebuild again, only to create stimulus, because the objective of creating all this housing. And I'm telling you, I went like 40 miles down a road and it was ghost cities the whole way. It was it was scary. It was unbelievable. Last question, then I will cut it off. This is from Heinrich Mierberg. He says, I've been a long believer of Mr. Dent's predictions. I think he has been proven right in the long run. However, central banksters and governments will not just sit on their hands and let markets crash. That much we know by now. They will act. Question, what makes Mr. Dent think that they won't this time, or at least they won't succeed to prop up the markets? If the markets crash, surely we'll just witness a new gigantic QE from central banks around the world. So why is this time different?
Well, you know, I mean, but this is correct. This has never happened before, and this is the big challenge I have faced, is that, yes, central banks all together in concert around the world have banded together and said, no, we're just not going to let it happen. If the economy loses trillions of dollars of stock or real estate value, we'll just print that much and pave it over. And to me, here's the problem with that. It has lasted a long time. They're not going to stop. But the consequence is not that you get inflation, which we're getting a little of. The consequence is you create bigger bubbles than ever. The Chinese real estate bubble is way bigger than it was several years ago. The most bubbly place in the United States are way worse. London's way worse. On and on. Vancouver is so ridiculous. They had to slap a 26% surcharge on foreign buyers just to stop the Chinese from bidding the stuff out of crazy. So you get these bubbles that burst, and at some point, you can't stop the bubbles from bursting. Bubbles burst from their own momentum. When something gets high enough in price, stocks, real estate, anything, Bitcoin, any gold, which was in a bubble into 2011, it will start to fall at some point because even rich people can't afford it. I was just seeing the latest condo. It used to be $100 million mark. The latest penthouse in New York is going to go for $250 million. And the latest, Hollywood house is now no longer $100, $120, $250 million. There's a point where the bubble just burst. Mm-hmm. So the hard part is, when is that going to happen? And you're right. Central banks have no other, once you've gone this far and pumped up things as much, even you know, the slightest pullback in stimulus will help burst the bubble. So they're not going to stop. It's just the economy is going to get surprisingly bad, or China's going to blow up, or Southern Europe. I mean, Italy is, you know, inches away from defaulting. 18% non-performing loans, terrible demographics, only better than Germany's, who's supposed to bail everybody out over there. There's a point where you just can't stimulate, you know, you can't keep a coma of patient alive at some point. But, you know, they can keep you in a coma a long time, and that's what central banks have done. I think that one of the things going to happen is we just run out of people to reemploy, and we get back down to normal workforce growth. And in the next year, all of a sudden, jobs are coming in at 30 to 80,000 instead of 150 to 200,000. Boy, I mean, how are the markets going to deal with that and keep going up?
Yeah. Well, Harry Dent, the author of many best-selling books and the latest, The Sale of a Lifetime, How the Great Bubble Burst of 2017 to 2019 Can Make You Rich, and editor of the free, that's what I said, free newsletter, Economy and Markets, which we'll show you how to get over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Well, thank you. Appreciate all your insight. Great book. I encourage my listeners to pick it up and read it. And cover to cover, I have it all dog-eared. I messed it up pretty good. I got it all like highlighted and dog-eared. So anyway, I'll see you soon. Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks, Andrew.
All right, bye-bye. As I had mentioned, you can get all of the information on how to get the free daily updates and newsletter from Harry Dent. Just go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can check out, of course, harrydent.com. It's something else that you could take a look at and find out more information there. But we'll have some more information on how to get the free newsletter and all that over on the show notes for this episode, number 493 of The Disciplined Investor. Again, disciplinedinvestor.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is my handle. And I mentioned this before we got to Harry, but I'll mention it once more. You can get daily updates from me. So for example, we wrote about uranium stocks. What's with these uranium stocks? What's the story about these, and why are they dropping? Why are they rising? If you've been following us on the uranium stocks, I know Frank Curzio has been talking about this as well, but they've been pretty much very interesting to look at, considering the fact we are entering back into, it looks like, the potential for a time when we have nuclear rearmament, at least a nuclear refresh possibly, as well as it looks like the use of nuclear power is now coming back into the mainstream discussion for many countries. And a lot of this is going to be very interesting to watch over time. As such, what companies are good? What companies have the opportunities? Well, we posted an article on that last, I think, Thursday. And you can see that on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But you would have gotten that article. You would have gotten that alert. You would have gotten that tweet if you signed up for the actual daily updates. It would have come in the email. Or if you would have had it on, followed us on Twitter, you would have gotten it immediately. So there was some great opportunity, by the way. The next day, one of the stocks we talked about a couple, but one of the stocks we talked about dropped pretty dramatically on one day, and the next day picked up pretty well, about 9%. The other one picked up like 29% the following day, and it's been vacillating back and forth on Friday. So anyway, take a look at some of the things there. Make sure to follow us. But uranium stocks are really interesting these days, and there's a lot of backdrop to why that could be, especially after they've had such a long and protracted downtrend that is finally seemingly to base. A lot of it will do to things like, well, not only the talk about using uranium in different ways, but also more importantly, the price of uranium, right? That's going to be something very interesting to watch as well. That will cause much of these stocks to move. I also mentioned that you can ask me questions. We have a few questions that came in that we asked Harry, but you can go to the Ask Andrew section on The Disciplined Investor. Now, for those of you out there that are DH Unplugged fans, myself and John C. Dvorak, every Tuesday night, we start talking at about 9 o'clock. And in the past, over the last, 8 years, we've covered just a tremendous amount of material on a weekly basis. It's not your normal business show. It's kind of outside the box. We talk about some serious items, some serious issues. But we also talk about the lighter side and the kind of looking at things a little bit differently than mainstream media looks at things. And we talk about really what's behind the news and really what some of this means and how to maybe profit on it. We also have a, a game we play with the audience, which is the closest to the pin, which we just had a winner crown for the recent one, which was Amazon.com. And we also have the weekly stock picks. Matter of fact, had some uranium stock picks in there. You would have had that about 3 days earlier than we talked about on the Disciplined Investor in that case. But here's the news. Here's what I want to tell you. For you people who are fans, the listeners who are listening to it, and you get it about an hour after we actually do it. Starting next week, it looks like, I'm not making a bold promise here, but I'm telling you what I think is going to happen here. Starting next week, we're actually going to be broadcasting that live as it happens, so you can listen to the actual discussion starting at 9 p.m. Eastern time on Tuesday night. Now, what you do is go over to DH Unplugged, dhunplugged.com. And if you follow us on Twitter, we'll also tweet this. But go over to dhunplugged.com. About 15 minutes beforehand, about 8:45 in the evening Eastern time on Tuesdays, you'll be able to start kind of getting into the live stream. And then once we start broadcasting, there you go. You're going to be live, and it's going to be right there. On the right-hand side, on the right side of the page, there's a little link that will take you right there. If it's not 8:45, if it's 8:20, well, you're not going to be able to get to the live stream. So you can do so at about 8:45, 8:50 in the evening. If you want to listen live to DH Unplugged and be on the show right when we're talking, well, you can do so by now getting live. I believe it's going to be next week. We'll give you more information as things progress over time, but that's going to be pretty exciting to get involved with, I think, because a lot of people want to hear it right then and there. You'll also, of course, be able to hear it recorded. You can listen to the podcast throughout the week on iTunes, wherever else that you listen to it, directly on the site, et cetera, and follow along with the stock picks and the games and all the things that we do, like the old codgers versus the millennials portfolio and all that. All that's on dhunplugged.com and a lot more that you can follow. Let's end it up with what's happening. We do have a lot more earnings that will be coming out over the next week or so. As I mentioned early at the top of the show, I think that we really need to be focused on what's going to be the environment that's going to be created over the next, I would say the next 2 weeks. Let's see exactly how much the new administration gets done. Let's see if the cabinet members and all the appointees can be approved in a reasonable time so something can get done. Let's see how harsh the commentary is, if he softens up a little bit, Donald Trump, that is, with some of the things that he was looking at, which I don't think he will. But let's look how he really deals with the wall over on the south side of the United States, over Mexico. Let's see how that plays out. Let's see what happens in terms of any tariffs, the border tax. Let's see what happens with the discussion of the repeal of Obamacare. And let us not forget, one of the campaign discussions, which is seemingly really not been talked about much, but we did see that gigantic march that was focused on the rights of women, and particularly regarding the right to life or the right for free choice of a woman's opportunity to, you know, have a child or abort it and make it, you know, it's their body. And we had this massive outflowing and this massive march all over the world. Pretty impressive to see, actually. Let's see if anybody takes notice of that and if there is any change to the discussion of possibly a further presentation of repealing Roe v. Wade. Because that really hasn't been talked about too much, but a lot of fear about that by many women. And we'll see how that plays out, if it's going to be as tough continuing on now that was the case. Because if you look at some things have softened, right? You know, Hillary Clinton was going to be put in jail. She's a criminal and her husband and all that. And then during the inaugural luncheon, it's, oh, Hillary Clinton, stand up. What great people. Really respect them. Wonderful people. So I don't know how much of this, some of the campaign rhetoric is going to be put into play or not. But again, this is, I talk about this not from a political standpoint, but from more so of how this was going to be reacting in markets. And a lot of the way that things were discussed and how it was discussed and the presentation of the information, the harshness and the the lack of any desire to have any kind of, let's say, leeway in any of the programs that he presented, we'll have to see if that's really going to play out. I think it's going to be very important when we look at many of the aspects of the markets moving forward. So anyway, with that, I thank you for listening. I wish you have a great week. Let's see how things play out next week. And we'll also talk about some of the great guests we have coming up. Have a great week. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.